Okay, well, we're glad you came tonight. We're in our historical study in a very interesting time of history because it somewhat overlaps some of our lives. Some of our class is younger enough not to remember, but some of us are old enough to remember part of it. I was asking a couple of the older guys today what they remember about World War II first, and I remember particularly D-Day because the Grand Island Daily Independent had two words when Germany said, "Germany surrenders above the fold." And I remember that. But I remember things about the war before that, too. But so I just barely remember World War II. All right, I just put a diagram up on the board. I don't have it as a part of my teaching tonight, except I just put it up there to kind of help you get a sense of the flow. The arch basically shows the zenith of Nazism, which probably was when he walked into Paris and looked at the Eiffel Tower and says, "I kind of like that place." And from there on, it was pretty much downhill for Hitler and the Nazis. But it took another few years before, from 41 to 45, another 4 years for him to realize he was dead. In the meantime, he killed a lot of people while he's trying to stay alive. So our lesson today is on the Holocaust, and it is I chose not to make it a gruesome lesson, if that's possible. I'm not going to tell you the horrors of it, but I do want to set up for you the background for it and obviously some of the things that happened, but there's enough on television that you can see for yourself, and there's no end of documentaries about the Holocaust and so forth. So we'll try to do a little more of a philosophical look at it, with the idea that you should remember, or we should remember, why this happened. And there's an answer for that in getting into my lesson. There's a reason why this happens. And we need to have that on top of our mind, so it doesn't happen again. Now, obviously, it's going to happen again for the Jews in the tribulation. So when you come to Hitler, and we did Hitler last week, remember, no greater chill is felt than at the hearing of the name Adolf Hitler. Similarly, no degree of fear is engendered, no greater fear is engendered than when you hear of the place called Auschwitz. Neither is unique in human history. I think of Attila Hun and all these other butchers of society that have been gone long. But these are kind of close to us. So neither is unique, but each has come to represent the worst of man, as far as we're concerned. When his actions, as far as he was concerned, was to be representing the best of man. So we ask this question, how could this have happened? And I say, we need to have an answer. I mean, I think we as Christians need to have an answer. It just didn't happen. There's something in just history that just sort of unattached. You know, we can't understand the beginning of it or the end of it. And this is the only gruesome picture I'm going to show you, is people in camps that are being waited for annihilation, and then they're killed and then buried, and then later on they will burn them. It's something that is hard to fathom. So I say the road to destruction, or the path to destruction, began in the early centuries of the Christian age by what seemed to be irresistible logic. The Gentile church assumed the prerogatives of spiritual blessing, but denied all blessings, including the future blessings, to the Jewish people, supposing that God had given up on his chosen people. There is the kernel. There is the kernel of Auschwitz. So it follows through then. When God gives up on a people, it is logical that the Christians who have been obedient, quote, I should have put that in quotes, should show God's disdain toward the Jews in a similar manner, and participate in God's judgment. This is not far-fetched, because this attitude toward the Jews was perpetuated by the organized church and in the established Reformation and Catholic churches to this very day. The Reformation Church, picking on Lutheran here particularly, made a new effort to convert the Jews to Christianity. I'm not sure what their efforts were, specifically, but they think they did. Not having understood the unqualified election of the Jews, when the Jews refused, compassion was replaced by anger and hate. Thus, modern-day anti-Semitism found a new life. I want you to have that in your... I've gone over this many times. I want you to have this in your mind when it comes to some of the atrocities that happened in World War II. This is where it started. It's not what they intended, but this is where it started. So the utopian world, Christian postmillennialism. Hitler borrowed water from three wells to serve up his concoction of death. First of all, the well of Darwinism, the inevitable human progress. Then the well of a form of Christianity, postmillennialism, forming utopia and a 1,000-year superior nation. Got that from Christianity. Then we have the well of anti-Semitism. In order to have this nation, this utopia, we have to get rid of the evil that's in the world, which is getting rid of the Jews. So all of this fits very well in the day when he was maybe growing up, a young person, and the ideal of postmillennialism. Things are getting better. Someday it'll be perfect. He's here to make sure that happens. We have Darwin now that's going to jet us along the way. So we've talked about three streams. We talked about three wells. I'm going to talk about three streams. We've been talking about the Christian stream, the Jewish stream, and the Gentile or political stream. And both of these streams have a negative and a positive. On the Christian side, we find that discovery of Jewish promises, like we would understand, I call them futurists or dispensationalists, is the positive side. On the other side of Christian stream, we have the replacement theology leads to first covenantalism, and then obviously with it comes this anti-Semitism that we see in the mainline churches. Now in the Jewish stream, we have this division again. We have those that are maybe called Orthodox, the Sephardic Jews who wear black. They still believe that the Messiah is coming. They self-identify with the Jews. But then we have, on the other side, the Jews that now want to be assimilated or have assimilated, and they've lost their identity, and leads to a form of self-hatred. Anti-Semitism, we now call them just the secular Jews, and they can be anti-Zionist. Then we have the political. We've seen Churchill being on the political side, supportive of the Jews, a filial Semite. He loved the Jews. And then we have one that's on the political side that's acting in an anti-Semitic way, and we have Hitler. So we have these three streams, and both of the streams go against each other. And obviously the ones in the left side are the correct ones, or the most, what can I say, most correct. We won't talk more about Churchill tonight, except to remember that he was a person that God used to establish Israel as a nation. He actually doesn't, he's not the midwife of it, but he carries the water up to it. We'll talk about that 2 weeks, I think. Now we talked last week, 2 weeks ago, we did Churchill. Now last week we did Hitler, Adolf Hitler, and he was the negative aspect of that political stream. So our lesson plan has been, we've done Churchill, lover of the Jews, we've done Hitler, drinking from these three wells, and hater of the Jews. And now we talk today about the expression of hate by the world led by Germany's Hitler, and it produced the Holocaust. And we'll talk about the response to the world. This is next week with FDR and America's involvement in the World War II. So we'll move our study to the United States and other places as the only power that could have launched a rescue effort. All the other nations were too small or absorbed in war against the Nazis, couldn't do it. And then we go into the issue of forming the nation of Israel. I don't know why I told you that, because I always do it differently than I say I'm going to do, but that's generally the plan. Now, I want to remind you that when we get into these sections that are really hard to do, and it's very easy to have empathy and sorrow for these people that are suffering at the hand of Hitler and other anti-Semites, but realize that the Bible has addressed this back in Deuteronomy, and the Lord tells Moses at the time the children of Israel were going to go into the land, obviously for the first time they come out of Egypt, and Moses preaches these messages to them, and he warns them about their future. And he says to them in Deuteronomy 28:58, if you are not careful to observe all the words of the law which are written in this book, to fear this honored and awesome name, the Lord your God, then the Lord will bring extraordinary plagues on you and your descendants, even severe and lasting plagues and miserable and chronic sicknesses. Verse 62, and then you shall be left few in number, whereas you were as numerous as the stars of heaven, because you did not obey the Lord your God. Verse 63, and it shall come about that as the Lord delighted over you to prosper you and multiply you, so the Lord will delight over you to make you perish and destroy you, and you will be torn from the land where you are entering to possess it. Verse 64, moreover, the Lord will scatter you among the peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth, and there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, which you and your fathers have not known. Verse 65, among those nations you shall find no rest, and there will be no resting place for the sole of your foot, but there the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, and despair of soul. So your life shall hang in doubt before you, and you will be in dread day and night, and you shall have no assurance of your life. And the Lord will bring you back to Egypt in ships by the way about which I spoke to you. You will never see it again, and there you will offer yourself for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there will be no one to buy or no buyer. So I believe that Deuteronomy 28 and 29 gives us an outline of the general judgment that have occurred in the life of Israel since they have rejected their Messiah. So I think it covers the diaspora, and our study, I think, is in that pre-tribulational period of the tribulation. Pre-tribulation, I mean, it's in that period before. And these judgments that have been observed, like in our lesson today, are leading to the Holocaust and finally to the Great Tribulation. Remember, in the Holocaust, a little less than one out of two Jews were killed. In the Great Tribulation, two out of three will be killed. So if you measure it by how many killed or die as a result of the judgment, the greatest Holocaust yet, it won't be called a Holocaust, although there will be an intention, I suppose, to kill everybody, is still yet to come. So there are passages that talk about the details of severe judgment, but most likely, I mean elsewhere, but most likely they're talking about the tribulation period. So I think we have Deuteronomy as the main passage that talks about this pre-tribulational period, which really goes from the day that Moses spoke till the day we live in today. Now, the Jewish plight is passed by the nations. This is probably my most favorite, unfavorite picture. I see a little guy here, probably 4 years old, laying on the paving. I think this is probably Warsaw. And no one's stopping to even hardly glance. This one lady looks down at him, but no one's going to do anything, and the caption said, he will be dead by morning. And I'm thinking, well, my good side of me says, if we believe that children go to heaven, he is one of the fortunate ones. So I've thought, if he is in heaven, wouldn't it be fun to go talk to him when we get to heaven and talk about this experience? I'd like to apologize to him for the people that did this to him. But that's the condition of the nation of Israel. These things are happening to Israel, and people just walk by. Hardly give them a glance. They're just the Jews. So our intention to mention these passages is to forestall any biblical reaction we might have to blame God for allowing the suffering to continue, because it's severe. From a humanitarian viewpoint, the atrocities of the world against the Jews are unconscionable. I'm not sure if they're equaled. So we have this passage out of Ezekiel 14. It says, moreover, I will make you a desolation and reproach among the nations and will surround you in the sight of all who pass by. So this little boy, in a sense, represents the nations, and the people just walk by. And that is exactly what happened. I'll say this later on. I said that Adolf Hitler, whatever you want to call him, he was probably the detonator in the bomb, but the explosive material was the rest of the world. So we don't want to put too much blame or too little blame on Hitler, but the world was complicit, and that's what our lesson is about next week. So we look at the Jews, and we say when Stephen was preaching his final message before he was stoned, he called the Jews the stiff-necked people. That's still true. You know, it's still true. And that's not going to change. But our attitude can't change. They're still God's people. They still are to be honored as God's people. All right, so we have this tug of war. So what do you think when a car passes you at 20 miles an hour over speed limit and down the road you find the driver killed himself in a wreck? First impulse says, deserved it. Deserved that. Maybe it wasn't so severe. Maybe it got stopped by a cop. Then we'd say, deserved it. Well, similarly, when we see the Jewish rejection of the truth and their judgment, we may have the same thought. Well, they deserve it. Guard the impulse. Remember, it's God's grace that saves us. Now, this is what Martin Luther gave in to, this impulse. After making an unsuccessful effort to convert the Jews, he turns on them, whom he supposedly loved, because they resisted the truth. Hitler used Luther's attitude to justify genocide. So be careful what you say and who's listening. So we must never succumb to that kind of reaction. We must never participate in derogatory, unfair characterization that demean or dehumanize the Jews. It doesn't mean you can't describe what they are, but you know how it is. They do good at business deals. That's true. I don't think that's derogatory. To me, that's a strength that they have. Or the great artists, the great artisans, you know, more people in the profession are Jewish than the regular Gentile, and that's a credit to them, not a derogatory thing. Now, God remembers the treatment of the Jews that they received at the hands of those that treat them. We have a history to see this at the national level. We have Assyria, Babylon, Rome, and we can now maybe add to this the decline of the empire. It corresponds exactly with the British mandate when they mishandled it severely, and the British Empire, on which the sun never set, began to disintegrate. Now, I'm not terribly comfortable going into that kind of prognostication, but we have Bill Koenig in his book, Israel, the Blessing or the Curse, details that with our recent history. I say I'm not sure I agree with it, but there's somebody who's trying to make a point of that as America, for example, has been good to the Jews, they've been blessed. When they've done something against Israel, they've had calamities. I just say I'm not a very good prophetic guy, so you might just be something to think about. Remember when Benjamin Disraeli, who was the prime minister of England, first Jewish prime minister, said that God deals with the nations as they deal with the Jews. It has almost become proverbial, and I think we would probably reflect that as being a biblical principle. So we come to the Holocaust. Let's look at the word. The word in Hebrew, or the word that Hebrews use for it, is called the great wind. In Greek, Holocaust originally meant a sacrifice consumed by fire, a burnt offering. It came to mean a sacrifice of a large scale, and by the end of the 6th, 17th century, the complete destruction of a large number of persons, a great slaughter or massacre. So, Holocaust is an example of genocide, which literally means the annihilation of a race, which is first used of the Jews in 1944. Now, the blame for the Holocaust. It goes without saying that the self-righteous are occupied with laying blame, culpability, for every act in history, as long as the self-righteous are not implicated, so we blame Hitler. Not totally wrong, but as we said, there's no more despicable name in modern history than the name Hitler. It is likely that any defense of Hitler would be derided. Any display of the swastika is punishable by complete ostracism, hate speech worthy of prison sentence. And I almost am fearful to put up a swastika on my lesson presentation. Somebody might walk in and say, oh, there's some skinheads in there. However, we believe that Hitler and his despicable treatment of the Jews and minorities, remember, even the Jehovah's Witnesses were in that group that he persecuted. Remember that? Gypsies, other odd people that were nonconformist, could have, however, we believe that Hitler and his deplorable treatment of the Jews and minorities could not have accomplished a fraction of the destruction if it were not for the compliant and willing world. In support, there are severe pogroms before Hitler. and there are severe anti-Semitic acts after Hitler. Obviously, it didn't need Hitler. Hitler was a facilitator, certainly, a mastermind madman, but he accomplished the impossible with the help and neglect of the Europeans, perhaps, and maybe to a larger or to a lesser degree in the United States, and I guess we'll leave that up to you to judge next week. So, Z plan. Last week, we talked about Hitler and the Nazi Germany, his meteoric rise to power and his despotic rule, first over Germany, then over nearly the rest of the Europe. Now, what I have on my board here, if I just can mention it, he came to power in January 30, 1933. He took the Rhineland, which is the Alsace area right across from the Rhine River, which is France. It's French-speaking Germany. And he took that by almost by invitation to walk in, says, this is our land. He said, oh, okay. French didn't do anything to lift their finger. They could have defeated Hitler at that point. They didn't. Appeasement was better. He walked to Austria, German-speaking people, and he said, Sieg Heil, and they said, fine with us. And they embraced him, and they welcomed him with parades, and they appointed a new Nazi government, and everybody went home happy. Not a shot fired yet. Then we come to Poland, September 1, 1939. He goes in there and takes Poland by force, and in less than 2 months, a month and a week or so, Poland is taken. They give up. And then he turns around, comes back to the Low Country, which would be in Belgium and Holland, and then he goes into France. And there he fought for a little bit more than a month, kind of like Poland, just a little bit longer. And walks into Paris. He didn't bomb Paris. He liked Paris, thought it was a beautiful city. So I should have brought you the picture of Hitler standing in front of the Eiffel Tower. Said, "This, I'm home. I always liked Paris. This is mine now." But you notice that that's the peak of his rise. And he hasn't really done much yet. Somebody said before, did Hitler ever really fight a war? Well, in a sense, he didn't, because Poland was easy. The only one you can really say was a war. France almost hardly, 30-day war? I mean, it's hardly nothing. Remember World War I lasted 4 years? Hardly a war. So we have a peak there, and then we have the mistake at Dunkirk, where Hitler paused because he thought that they shouldn't attack the British that were assembled on French side of the canal. And while he waited in disagreement with the generals, 300,000 of the British escaped. Well, when that was over, he wasn't going to go to England. So he had his opportunity. So I'm saying that that was his downfall. And then we have the rest of it on the way down. Then he attacks Germany, attacks Russia. And we're going to talk a lot about the Wannsee Conference today, because it was in that time when Germany was attacking Russia. Remember, they attacked in the spring of 41, June, and by the end of 40, is that 42? 41. At the end of 41, wintertime, those armies are getting frozen because they brought their summer wear. And then Hitler could not supply them with warm clothing. Can you just imagine being outside of Russia in dead of winter? I mean, you think it's bad out here. So it's almost like Napoleon again, if you remember his story. Okay, so we have Hitler rising to this to despotic power quickly, and we'll go over that little detail in a minute here. Now, Hitler believed in the Aryan supremacy, and we don't still know who the Aryans are, but that's the word he used. He's white-skinned, blonde-haired, but he was dark-skinned, black-haired. I don't know. Doesn't fit. Some say that he was part Jewish, which may be true. As Hitler believed in Aryan supremacy based on Darwinianism, he desired to breed a pure race of Germans and provide them adequate living space, Lebensraum, territories that were held by lesser people, as the Polish and the Slovakians, the Russians, Slovaks. How do you say that? The first obstacle to this two-pronged plan was to deal with the undesirables who could damage the German bloodline. Not new. The Jew has always been a problem in Europe. It's always been called the Jewish problem. And should finally be removed, finally, once and for all, and Hitler now has all these Jews on German soil. He's in charge. It's his turn. It's the time. Now, there's a matter of opinion here historically. You may have yours, and it's one of those kind of things that doesn't matter a lot, although I think one side's better. The question is, did Hitler, from the beginning of his public life, way back when he was fighting the barroom brawls after World War I, did Hitler, from the beginning of his public life, intend to destroy all the Jews? Or did the idea of their destruction, a systematic killing, develop as he gained greater territorial control over Western Europe? In other words, was that an idea that he thought about as he grew in power? There's two groups. One is the intentionalist, which is the guy that says, I think he had it in his mind all the time, a seminal, constant, unwavering intention to kill European Jewry from the very first. And then the functionalist, I had to make up these words, the functionalist is the one that believed that the plan for annihilation was reached via a twisted road with many dynamisms within and without Germany that were responsible, helped to bring about the Holocaust, the plan developed incrementally. I believe the last one is the right answer. We'll have the evidence for it this evening, starting here. While killing of the Jews was going on from, and I try to find out when this started, because Hitler starved and let people die by disease. Is that killing? You know, in a sense it was, but I don't have the right date there. So let's don't count anything before 33, because he wasn't in power yet. 33, January 30 is when he came to power. And somewhere in the early years, for sure by the time you get to 38, we have some killings already going on by shooting by Hitler. So while killing of the Jews was going on, political killing occurred in 1934, the Night of the Long Knives. There was welcome attrition, as I just mentioned, by starving, disease, individual killing perhaps, by shooting or hanging. But in time, these measures could not keep up with the sentence to death. Those would be sentenced to death. I'm just talking about in a scope here about 4 or 5 years. As more and more Jews were shipped to extermination centers, more industrial means were necessary to handle the killing and disposal of the dead. Then also the psychological problem facing the executioners, looking to the eyes of the victims, and many of them were women and children, and it started to take its toll. So the Wannsee Conference, January 20, 1942, in Berlin, was called by a Polish governor, Hans Frank, although he had not much to do with what happened there. But he wanted to discuss and coordinate the activities of the final solution, which is a little bit anachronism because it came out of that conference. So the functionalists, my view, we may think that Hitler was so obsessed with killing the Jews that it had to be part of his original thinking. I think not. However, there's good evidence that killing them was the last solution, not the first, if they could not be deported. I'm just showing you a map of where all the Jews were deported from, and I have no time to stop explain it all to you because it's too small to see. But they came from everywhere in Germany, and they went everywhere in the world at first. Between 1933 and 1941, the Nazis aimed to make Germany Judenrein, cleaned of Jews, by making life so difficult for them that they would be forced to leave the country, kind of like Augustine's approach to the Jewish problem. By 1938, about 150,000 German Jews, one in four, had fled the country. I would say they're the lucky ones. You know what I mean, lucky. After Germany annexed Austria in March of 38, however, an additional 185,000 Jews were brought under Nazi rule. Now he's got a bigger problem. Many Jews were, and then we did this in Poland in 1939, he got another bunch of Jews. So all these Jews, many Jews were unable to find countries willing to take them. In this period, now this is very important, in this period Hitler's plan was to evacuate the Jews from German territories. What he said. I can only hope that the other world, which has such deep sympathy for these criminals, will at least be generous enough to convert their sympathy into practical aid. We are ready to put all these criminals at the disposal of these countries, even on luxury ships. So I don't see anything here that he wants to kill them. He just wants to get rid of them. In fact, we'll send them out first class if they'll go. Well, so far we think we're on track here, right? Well, then we come, Evian, is that how you say that, you French people? The Evian Conference, summer 1938. Delegates from 32 countries met at the French Azort Evian. Roosevelt chose not to attend. Send a high-level official, such as the Secretary of State. Instead, Taylor, a businessman and close friend of Roosevelt's, represented the U.S. at the conference. During the nine-day meeting, delegates after delegate rose to express sympathy for the refugees. But most countries, including the United States and Britain, offered excuses for not letting more refugees, letting in more refugees, considering the unemployment levels. That was the reason they gave. Remember, 38 was during the Depression. No one had a job. So one of these little things that, is that part of a puzzle that God's working? Probably. But still, we'd say, in our compassion, we'd say, doesn't matter. This is a matter of life and death for these people. Well, the ideas have consequences, is abundantly demonstrated by the ideas of Darwin. Consequences that no one could foresee, unless they were serious Bible students like us. We have shown that Hitler's ideas were built on Darwinian evolutionary ideology, wrong idea, the supremacy of the Aryan race. But it is one thing to promote your supremacy. It is another step, and I say unexpected step, even for Hitler, to force the elimination of the inferior, to kill him. That's something I'm sure he didn't think about to begin with. But as you live with your ideals, and if you live with your ideology, you find yourself, you have no way to go. Every other avenue for you is blocked. So you take the next more drastic step. And I always think at this point, well, if you're going to believe so much in evolution, why don't you just let it take care of itself? You know, if the weak are that weak, they'll die out. Well, we don't have time. So we have authority and restrictions, 1933. How did all this happen? Hitler, Chancellor of Germany, January 30, 1933. The Enabling Act, 3 months, January, February, March, 2 months. January, February, March, 2 months. The Enabling Act passed March 24, 1933, and was signed by President Paul von Hindenburg, who was the Kaiser. Later in that day, the Enabling Act gave Hitler plenary powers. What does plenary mean? We have the plenary inspiration of the Bible. What do we mean? Complete. Complete. Whole. So it's plenary power means complete powers. It followed on the heels of the Reichstag fire decree. I didn't read about that, but I think the fire of the Reichstag, their White House or the Capitol, their parliament, maybe somebody knows about that. I didn't study it, but I think it was blamed on some people, the reactionary to the government. So they gave a reason to crank up, you know, the laws, like in our land when we had the 9/11 attack. Bush enacted some really stringent laws on surveillance that couldn't have been done otherwise. So you have these emergency measures that are set up by countries because of unusual situation. Now, this fire probably caused an unusual situation, and so now for a time being, in fact, this is supposed to only be for 4 years, these powers were getting, well, when you're in power for 4 years, it's pretty easy to extend that for another four and so forth. So it wasn't very many months. I'm getting ahead of my story. All right, so he gets plenary powers. It followed on the heels of the Reichstag fire decree, which abolished most civil liberties and transferred state powers to the Reich government. The combined effect of the two laws was to transform Hitler's government to a de facto legal dictatorship. Hitler was stickler on the law. Kinda. But he did it so that it looked good. I mean, so on. Now, it seems like Hitler had already thought through this by the time he had come to power in 1933. I didn't read his Mein Kampf, but it got it. But from what I read about what he wrote and how he was functioning, it seemed like he had this in mind. If the economic engine, the ability to produce and provide, is removed, like a plant without water, the Jews will move out of Germany. He would even put them on a luxury ship, remember? So that'd be step one, cut them off from the economy. So rather than forbid the Jewish shop owners to sell their product, Hitler appealed to the supposedly sympathetic population and forbade them to buy at Jewish shops. So we forced them out of business in Germany, and that began the boycott, which was the first experimental step. Now, look at this. Joseph Goebbels talked to this crowd. Says the Nazi minister of propaganda speaks at a rally in favor of the boycott of Jewish-owned shops. Now, there's a lot of people standing there. So I would say this is kind of a big issue. Now, this thing only lasted a day. Hitler on the power, I said, January 30, organized by local Nazi party chiefs, lasted only one day, was ignored by many of the individual Germans who continued to shop in Jewish-owned stores. It marked the beginning of a nationwide campaign by the Nazis party against the entire German Jewish population. Part of the reason I've read elsewhere that it didn't succeed or they pulled it off is because the Jews that the Germans were depending on to supply their products weren't going to sell to them. It's kind of a boycott in reverse. So I guess they turned off the boycott. I didn't realize it only lasted one day, but it was really a turning point in the power. Now, this is breathtaking. In 6 months, he becomes chancellor January 30. The Enabling Act of March 24, same year. April 1, the Jewish boycott. May, ban trade unions, no striking, no legal. Striking was illegal. May, June's ban from government jobs. He had a government job out. May, again, Jews banned from the army. June, Jews banned from the restaurants. I say, that did it. July, other political parties were deemed illegal except the Nazi party. In July, Hitler made an agreement with the Catholic Church. It agreed not to oppose the political and social aims of the Nazi party. We got 6 months worth of time here. The whole, you know, you want change? There you are. Fast. In July of that year, we have Dachau now established as a concentration camp for political prisoners. These are not Jews yet. Some say never got there. I don't know. It's still out there disputed. Come September, Jews cannot inherit land. Well, boy, you're in trouble then. If you can't have property. September, Goebbels made Minister of Enlightenment and Propaganda, and we know how good he was at that. And then we have the law for engagement of marriage. Now, this is really interesting. This is really interesting. One of the earliest laws passed by Hitler once he came to power in 1933 was the law for the encouragement of marriage. The law stated that all newly married couples would get a government loan of 1,000 marks salary. So if you're a $30,000 person, you'd probably get something like $17,000. That's pretty good. Okay, so 800,000 newlyweds took up this offer. Now, the loan was not simply to be paid back. The birth of one child meant 25% of the loan did not have to be paid back. Two children meant 50% of the loan didn't have to be paid back. And four children meant the entire debt would be cleared. Now, here we have a despotic tyrant running a country. And he makes this statement about the family. What does he see that our government doesn't see? Or our culture doesn't see? The value of the family. Without kids, lots of them, there ain't, no Germany. That's it. I said, why is this such a hard lesson? And I got to go to Hitler to find that. You know, this is not surprising he did this, because this is going to be strengthening his country. We haven't learned that, or we're whatever. Do I need to say any more? You got it. June 30 and July 2, 1934, the Nazi Party leadership, on the order of the Nazi Party leader and the Reich Chancellor Adolf Hitler, purged the leadership of the Nazi paramilitary formation, they call them the stormtroopers. I won't try to say it in German. The stormtroopers, the SA officers. They're not the SS officers. They will stay. The leaders took advantage, the Nazi leaders took advantage of the purge to kill other political enemies, primarily on the German national right. So it'd be more like governmental leaders rather than that would follow, be loyal to Hitler. Loyal to Hitler. Now you go on the internet, you find newspaper articles about that event. It's the Long Knives event, known as the Night of Long Lives, or Operation Hummingbird. The murderers cemented an agreement between the Nazi regime and the German army and enabled Hitler to proclaim himself Führer of the National Socialistic Germany, that's Nazi, and to claim absolute power. Now, we notice here it says on that newspaper, their Knickerbocker, I like that, Hitler executes 7. Apparently, it wasn't a secret. It made front page. Then we have another one. More killed in German revolt. January 34, abolished local government. June, night of the long knives, SA controlled by the SS, consolidated the powers of the SS under Hitler. Hitler, in relentless executions, kills off leaders in attempt to suppress the Second Revolution. I guess I didn't type that. I thought I did, but I didn't. So that's the subtitle. The next one, where I'm pointing, new warning goes forth that those who conspire against the state are playing with their own heads. Nervous fear and uncertainty grips country following mutiny and bloodshed. This is not done in a closet somewhere. This is known by the public and is being printed reported openly in the newspaper. Rumor has it that von Hindenburg has willed, he was dying, his presidency to von, I couldn't see the last name, it was blurred. Now, under arrest. The new guy that's going to follow Hindenburg is under arrest. This is the newspaper. Hundreds of stormtroop sub-leaders arrested. Officials withhold figures. That's an open government, I guess. So we see what's happening here with Hitler. He's taking more and more control. With Hindenburg gone, which he dies here, he's the last possible holdout to control Hitler. So August 2, President Hindenburg dies. Full authority goes uncontested to Hitler. Originally published in August 1934, whatever opposition from a new president he has removed, put him in jail, remember? He, that is Hitler, has all in his hands. That's in the newspaper. Not done in a corner somewhere. September 15, 1935. Institutionalizing many of the racial theories prevalent in Nazi ideology. The laws excluded German Jews, Reich citizenship, prohibited them from marrying or having sexual relations with any person of German or related blood, did not define a Jew as someone with particular religious beliefs. Doesn't matter if you could be an atheist, you're still a Jew. Instead, anyone who had 3 or 4 Jewish grandparents were defined as a Jew, regardless of whether that individual identified himself, herself, as a Jew or belonged to the Jewish religious community. It didn't matter. So we have also Goering preparing for a war. It's called the 4-year plan. Hitler's program to make German army operational in the German economy fit for war. Within 4 years, Hitler appointed Hermann Goering to oversee the implementation of the plan. I think it's against the Versailles Treaty. They can't arm themselves like this. I just had to throw this in here because this was a big PR thing for Hitler, 1936, the Winter Games, and some of you have read Louis Zamperini's book. He was the Olympic carrier there, runner, and World War II. He was ditched in the Pacific Ocean, spent months in the water. If you have not read Unbroken, Rodenbroken, is that it? If you've not read Unbroken, don't start because you will not be able to put it down until you're done. So anyway, that's Louis Zamperini. In fact, he just died last year. He was 90-something when he died. Became a believer at the Billy Graham Crusade in 1949 in Los Angeles. Interesting story. All right, well, you see at Nuremberg on the right, you see the everything is, when Hitler and the Germans did something, I mean, it was immaculate. Look at the lining up of gymnastics things, whatever. And Jesse Owens, by the way, the first black guy, because that didn't suit Hitler very well, won a gold medal. Anyway, I just threw that in here because this was going on during this time, and it was a big, you know, PR coup for Germany. They haven't invaded Germany or Poland yet. Now we're still in 38. In March, Jews register their possessions. July, Jews carry identification cards. In July, doctors and dentists can't work on Arian. And then we have in 38 the mass eviction of the Jews to the Polish border. And you see these are arrows that put poles at this spot, which is the border, and there's another spot down here. We're interested in this one. Can you see what I'm doing? Okay. So this is a big deal. Big deal. About 17,000 Polish Jews are expelled by Germany and forced across the border with Poland. Poland refused to allow the Jews to enter. So they're trapped. Most of the deportees are stranded in the no man's land between Germany and Poland near this town of, however you say that. Can you help me out there? My Polish friend? Too many Z's and S's and Bazin. Among the deportees are the parents of Herschel Greenspan. I can read that one. A 17-year-old Polish Jew living in Paris, France. 17-year-old. Okay. On November 7, Polish Jew Herschel Greenspan shot a German man, actually an official, because Nazis had killed his parents. Now, this becomes provocation. November 9 and 10, the night of the broken glass, was a massive, coordinated attack, not spontaneous at the embassy, none of that, coordinated, well-planned attack on Jews throughout Germany. So we have onlookers watch as the local fire department prevents the fire from spreading to nearby houses, but make no attempt to stop the synagogue from burning. So Herschel Greenspan, I'll recover here with some detail, 17-year-old Polish Jew living in Paris, shoots Ernest von Rath, a diplomat attached to the German embassy in Paris. Greenspan apparently acts out of despair over the fate of his parents, who are trapped along with other Polish-Jewish deportees in a no-man's land between Germany and Poland. The Nazis used the shooting to fan anti-Semitic favor, claiming that Greenspan did not act alone, but is part of a wider Jewish conspiracy against Germany. Von Rath dies 2 days later. So party members, Nazi party members, are gathered in the commemoration of the abortive Nazi Putsch in 1923. Hitler tried to seize power. It was worried why he went to jail, and where he wrote his book, Mein Kampf. After the speech, Nazi officials ordered the stormtroopers, the SA, and other party formations to attack Jews and destroy their homes, businesses, and houses of worship. The violence against the Jews lasts into the morning hours of November 10 and becomes known as Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass. Several dozen Jews lost their lives. Tens of thousands were arrested and sent to concentration camps. It's the first one that were actually sent. The first one was deported to Poland. This was sent to concentration camps. 2 days later, over 250 synagogues were burned. I think I saw 7,500 Jewish businesses were trashed, looted, dozens of Jewish people killed, Jewish cemeteries, hospitals, schools. Homes were looted while the police and fire brigade stood by. And you see the paper in the middle there says, Jews now fined for Nazi riots. So when they burned down their place, they had to pay to replace them. And if they got insurance money, that money had to be turned over to the state. So the Jews were a loser, a loser, a loser. The night of the broken glass, life was even more difficult after the night of the broken glass. Life was even more difficult for German, Austrian, Jewish children and teenagers. Already barred from entering museums, public playgrounds, swimming pools, they now were expelled from public schools. Jewish youngsters, like their parents, were totally segregated in Germany. In despair, many Jewish adults committed suicide, and most families tried desperately to leave but couldn't. Although you see some are leaving and coming to America, South America, Israel, and even into China. So the Warsaw Ghetto. Established in November 1940, it was surrounded by wall, contained nearly 500,000 Jews, maybe as many as, a dozen and a half in, no, eight, let's say less than a dozen in a room, I shouldn't say less than a dozen, up to a dozen in a room. 45,000 Jews died there in 1941. Remember the attrition, the dying by attrition is just as good as shooting. In fact, it's better. It's more natural. As a result of overcrowding, hard labor, lack of sanitation, insufficient food, starvation, and disease. I see here a mother with their children. If your heart doesn't go out to that, you're hard. So we have the concentration camps, where prisons used without regard to accepted norms of arrest and detention. They were an essential part of the Nazi systematic oppression initially. They were used primarily for political we saw that with Dachau. Later, 36, 42, concentration camps, and non-political prisoners, Jews, Gypsies, homosexuals, and the Poles, were also incarcerated. In the last period of the Nazi regime, 42-45, the prisoners of concentration camps were forced to walk in the armament industry, work in the armament industry, as more and more Germans were fighting in the war. Living conditions varied considerably from camp to camp over time. The worst conditions took place in 36-42, especially after the war broke out. Death, disease, starvation, crowded and unsanitary conditions, and torture were daily part of the concentration camps. As we begin, steps towards genocide were taken because they were expedient, not as a pre-planned fashion. Broadly, the steps were isolate the culture by measures of boycott and identification bags, which really came later. Isolation physically from the population in special areas called ghettos. Deport them to other countries if possible, and very few were available. Deport them to concentration camps, isolated from culture. Transfer them to extermination camps by railroad or by walking, usually by railroad. Industrialize the euthanasia process. Shooting or hanging is too slow. Industrialize the disposal of those euthanized, cremation versus burials. That's kind of the plan. The battle fatigue and mental anguish caused by shooting large numbers of women or children strained the executioners. This demanded an alternative. Gassing victims, first of all, in mobile units in June 41, then stationary units, like buildings, rooms, in 42, using carbon monoxide from a running engine. The truck would just pipe the gas into their van in the back, and by the time they got to where they're going, everybody was dead. So those who were put into the enclosed van removed. One, personal repulsion, that is, didn't have to look them in the eye when you kill them, but it did, and it did aid in efficiency. The gas vans would drive about 20 miles an hour because of the destination, so they'd get there at the right time. But the weight of their duty bore on them, so the drivers tend to drive faster, and you get to the destination to find out everybody was dead, and was not dead. I mean, can you just imagine the difficulty? So a better solution was sought to the Jewish problem. We're talking about industry here. It's like industry, like making shoes. It was during the summer and fall of 1941 that Hitler, with discussions with other Nazi leaders, Himmler, particularly that mass euthanization, whatever the word is, of the entire Jewish population became the policy to promote to the rest of the Nazi leadership. And Hitler was a stickler on rule-keeping. He needed legal cover for his devilish operations, make sure that his fingerprints were kept off and the incriminating records be destroyed. For the change of policy, he sent Heinrich Himmler to do the axe work at Wannsee. Now, before we do that, we've got to talk about Zyklon B. This is about this time, the gas. Zyklon B was used to fumigate clothing that was carried, a rat-borne flea that carried typhus. A very dangerous poison in pellet form was used by the United States as early as 1920 in executions, criminal executions. All the camps had this chemical and used it for fumigation of deportees' clothing. They all came less lice infected, and of course the disease was rampant with typhus. It was an observant Sturmführer, Karl Fritsch, that thought about using it on Russian prisoners of war when he placed in the basement housing POW. He poisoned them with this available substance. It did not take much for him to put two and two together as an answer to the final solution. Zyklon B blocks the process by which oxygen is released from the red blood corpuscles, and the result is a sort of internal asphyxiation. This is accomplished by symptoms, accompanied by symptoms of injury, respiratory system, combined with the feeling of fear, dizziness, and vomiting. Do you love that? Okay, now we got to know about the gas. In the Wannsee Conference, January 20, 1942, in Berlin, was called by Polish Governor Hans Frank to discuss and coordinate the activities of the final solution. He wasn't aware what that was yet, I'm sure. But they were having problems getting everything done. Heidrich Himmler chaired the meeting. Assuming the functionalist viewpoint, which is what I'm doing, the WANSI conference in Berlin was the organizing coordination conference for the final solution, decided by Hitler earlier that year. Hess, this, by the way, there are two Rudolf Hesses. That's really confusing. One Rudolf Hess flew his airplane into England and abandoned his airplane there and became an asylum. But they killed him. I think they killed him. They didn't take his asylum. But anyway, that's not this Rudolf Hess. This is a little different. This one's spelled with an umlaut on it. The other one's spelled with an E. So this is the one with the umlaut, the bad one. Okay, we have Hess recalls that in summer 1941, before WANSI that summer, he was summoned to Berlin by Heidrich Himmler himself. In a few sparse words, Himmler told him of Hitler's decision to annihilate the Jews. See, now, this is the first time that's ever been said. Up until now, the Jewish problem was met with disorganization and lack of consistent policy. Now, with the decision to exterminate the Jews as a policy of the state, can you imagine the weight of that statement? The policy of the state, utilizing all its resources, involving all of the personnel up and down the extermination chain, it was important that the top leaders, around 13 met, 13 to 14, would be brought on board or else, with the details all in place, ready to complete, which has to do with the gathering, the isolation, the transportation by rail system, the prepared destination, the provision of elimination, disposal, all needed industrial-wide efficiency. The conference was to ensure that. Okay, now I might mention to you a movie, if you like movies instead of reading. There's only a little bit of warning here. It has some language in it. If you can handle that, you'll enjoy it. I've seen it twice, and it is a good movie in that the text of it is from a manuscript that was recorded at the meeting. They were all supposed to have been destroyed, but one survived and was found in 1947. And the text of what those men said is from that manuscript. So it's relatively accurate, supposedly. So it's called Conspiracy, and if you have Amazon Prime, it's free. So go look at it. All right, so WANSI conference occurs, as I have my listing over here, in 1942, January 1942. We're moving on. I wrote down some of the men that are kind of the top people. Heidrich Himmler, he was Hitler's right-hand man. Then Reinhard Heydrich, the hangman, Hermann Goering, know him, he's the Air Force guy. Next one, this SS leader, I don't know much about him. Adolf Eichmann, we know him because he was in charge of the concentration camp at Auschwitz. Mengele, we know him because of his doctoring and his experimental work on kids, twins. And then we have Rudolf Hess, who was the camp commander at Auschwitz. Okay, so I just mentioned those guys because they are real people with real names. Auschwitz, Birkenau, something mixed up. This is really Birkenau, the one you always see. Can you see the railroad track going through it? That's really Birkenau, and this is Auschwitz, kind of across the road. And I just want to just briefly run through a couple of these pictures and let you go. I really love this, although it's a painting. It really captured the moment, I think, of arriving. I just can't imagine you were a Jewish person, and some of these people knew what was happening. And they arrive at a place like this, and the train stops, and you get off, and say, here we are. And it's that building is still standing. Now, the efforts of the Germans to destroy the Jews certainly hurried the defeat by Russia and the Allied powers. In other words, I think Hitler could have lasted longer, but with this third front that he opened up, it speeded up his demise. Hitler's man's policy made him a great candidate for a Satan-possessed tyrant. I mean, if ever was a man possessed by Satan, I mean himself, personally Satan, I think Hitler would have been worth his time. And I think it probably explains some of his activity, considering they were the Jews and they were the issue here between them and God. All right, so we have other pictures that are really from Auschwitz, not Birkenau. Birkenau just has this building. All these others have been blown up and removed. This is the gate where it's Arbeit, Mach 3, work makes you free. Another lie. Here's Auschwitz and all the places that they sent people. It was a rail center. That's why they chose it. And you see at the museum there, see all these bags that were left there with names and addresses where they could be returned, as they were told that they would get their bags back. There are a couple of shots of cutaway. There are models built there of these gas chambers that was built specifically for these executions. And they're just incredible. And here's a picture of Hitler in one of the rooms in Auschwitz. This is where they hung Rudolf Hess, the one with the umlaut, because they did catch up with him. And they make that a mark. And there's a plaque here. This is still at Auschwitz, a gas chamber. It's a small one. It's probably where the first use of Cyclone B was used on the Jews. You see Nick's picture. There's the chamber, and right through that door is these ovens. And it's still hard for me that they can dispose of so many bodies as quickly as they did. They say it takes about 20 minutes to dispose of a body. And you say, well, adding them up, but they go 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and no time off for vacation. So if you do that, all of a sudden you do get quite a few that are disposed of that way. Then where Marty and Marilyn Jatan were with us in whatever year it was, we were in Warsaw, and this is a picture of the Jewish cemetery. Here's Marty looking at it and marking of the ghetto where it was. Next picture we have where the ghetto was, and you notice the Christian church stands. But everything else is totally destroyed. Well, another reprise, lest we forget. The road path began in the early centuries of the Christian age by what seemed to be irresistible logic. The Gentile church assumed the prerogatives of spiritual blessings but denied all blessings, including future, to the Jewish people. Supposing that God had given up on the chosen people, when God gives up a people, it is logical that the Christians who have been obedient should show God's attitude towards the Jews and participate in God's judgment. Logical. But logic with deadly consequences. And I think that should come to our mind when we think about Auschwitz. It's just not something that happened out there away from us or from Christianity. It would use a perverted form of Christianity to accomplish it, and it was done with the complicit understanding of, quote, the Christian world, broadly spoken, and we'll talk about that next week. It's actually incredible. So Hitler was there, a man that God used to bring about this judgment, and we saw the judgment started with the warning in Deuteronomy, and the Jews have not heeded that warning, and they still haven't heeded it. And the last thing we want to do is be angry with them, because they're sinners just like you and I were. We'd be saved, lost just like they are, except for the grace of God, so we want to keep that in mind. All right, if you have some comments, I'd sure like to talk to you, so after class, come up here and talk to me. Let's pray. Lord, to pause again at the end of our class to be quiet in our souls a little bit about what has happened in these centuries or these days around our lifetime, where there has been such a wholesale attempt to wipe out the people of your choosing. Lord, with our Bibles in hand, we have a clear picture of what you're trying to do or what you are doing, and we're frustrated with those that don't see it. And frustrated that people that should see it can't see it. And Lord, we, again, can't claim superiority here, but Lord, just again, by your grace, that we understand what all this means. Help us, Lord, to realize that the Jews are your chosen people. They're disobedient, no doubt about that. They'll never be, you will never let them off the hook for their disobedience. But Lord, when it comes to our turn, it's time to share the gospel and show compassion, because they have been a stressed people over these years. Thank you, Lord, for these weeks we have together. Lord, even as we talk next week about our country and its reaction to the events that happened back in the 40s, that we might be careful to present it accurately and clearly, that you might be pleased with the presentation. Thank now our trip home. Keep us safe as we go, and our families, and for the opportunity to come each week, we thank you for it. Bless it all. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.